Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Mike Gill, on a Monday morning, give me an idea. What is the key to a fabulous get-up-and-go latte?
It's dropping the espresso right when you ask for it, and also heating up the milk just when you ask for it.
Well, that sounds great. How long have you been in this latte game, Mike?
Well, now I've been in it 5 years.
Is it fair to say you might be a bit overqualified for this gig?
Well, I thought that originally, but then when I got my job at Starbucks, I realized I was underqualified. It's really tricky to make the right drink in the right way.
But what did you used to do?
I used to be what they called a big shot advertising guy.
So 10 years ago, you were an advertising executive at a Madison Avenue firm, and now you're at Starbucks?
Yeah, you can see me sweeping up or making the drinks and even cleaning the toilets.
Man, that's a hard luck story. That's tough, Mike. Now think back to those great days in corporate America, and I want you to tell me, what was the best thing that ever happened to you?
The best thing that ever happened to me was getting fired from my big advertising job because I was able to discover that it's a lot more fun and enjoyable to serve coffee to others than it is to sit in crazy meetings.
Mike, make my latte a triple, bud, putting a foamy top on layoffs. Reinvention for breakfast. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, March 9th, and I am the reinvented John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora Udoji, who's taking time off to be with her new baby. Coming up this hour, if you don't want to reinvent yourself like Mike, we will show you what the pros recommend for saving your job. Also, Northern Ireland flares up after years of peace. We'll see what's behind the new violence, all that and more ahead. But first, the top headlines.
Asian markets struggling this morning. Japan's Nikkei is getting the worst of it. The benchmark is at a low not seen in more than 25 years. President Obama will reverse the Bush administration ban on embryonic stem cell research funding later this morning. We will have a conversation to explain what's next in just a moment.
And the president's auto task force is in Detroit today. They'll meet with car execs and union leaders. They want more detail on what automakers plan to do with nearly $40 billion in government loans that GM and Chrysler want. Ford is not seeking government loans yet, but it does want big concessions from the United Auto Workers Union, or UAW. Today, the results should come in from the UAW members voting on a new deal with Ford. It includes a pay freeze and loss of some job protections.
Transportation story. Speaking of cars, national gas prices rose nearly 2 cents in the latest Lundberg survey, and oil has topped $46 a barrel, driven up by some OPEC production cut rumors.
Circuit City is no more. The electronics retailer shut its doors for good on Sunday. That puts 34,000 people out of work. Customer Ken Frumkin was sad to see it go.
It's a real shame to see a big corporation like this go out of business. That means that there's less options for us to buy our electronics.
The chain made the call to close after going bankrupt and failing to find a buyer or a financial lifeline.
34,000 out of work people needing a reinvention. By the way, the markets start today poised downward. The S&P begins trading at 683. More than 500,000 Americans lost their jobs last month alone. If you're one of them, if you're looking at a pink slip from Circuit City, how are you going to proceed? Will you stay in the same career path, or is it time to reinvent yourself? Think of your interests, the things you've wanted to do but never did. Pottery, opening your own coffee shop, a how-to guide for how to grow your own victory garden. Tell us your new chosen career at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Wish list reinventions.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone, and good morning, Farai Chidea.
Good morning.
And I know you know the answer to this, but think back. It seems like, you know, probably a half century ago. Do you know the most important Bush administration story prior to 9/11? Here's a hint.
I have concluded that we should allow federal funds to be used for research on these existing stem cell lines, where the life and death decision has already been made. Leading scientists tell me research on these 60 lines has great promise that could lead to breakthrough therapies and cures.
As President Bush, speaking on August 10th, 2001, announcing a partial ban on stem cell research, a ban on embryonic stem cells, but proceeding with other stem cells. It's a ban that's been in force until this morning, when Barack Obama plans, in an announcement at about 11:45 this morning, to reverse that Bush administration doctrine, which created all kinds of impacts in the scientific research community that we're going to discuss now, and also see what the impact of the reversal is going to be. Joining us is Cheryl Gay Stolberg, reporter for The New York Times. She joins us from her home in Maryland. Cheryl, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And Dr. George Daly, Associate Director of Stem Cell of the Stem Cell Program at Children's Hospital in Boston. He's also an Associate Professor at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Daly, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
This is a twofold story, it seems to me. Cheryl, let me begin with you. Number one, it's about this reversal and this old debate over embryonic stem cells and how it got mixed up in the pro-life abortion debate in politics. But it's also a story about Obama's professed interest in removing politics from all kinds of basic science. Which is the most important this morning, do you think, Cheryl?
Well, I think the announcement that will make the biggest news, and already has, is the overturning of the Bush stem cell restrictions. But equally important is the president's pledge to, as he said in his inaugural address, restore science to its rightful place. And what he means by that is that he wants government to really take a clear and unbiased view of scientific information. He wants the best possible science advisors to advise his administration on a range of issues, from climate change to the Endangered Species Act to family planning matters. And this is yet another attempt to undo what he believes were the wrongs of the Bush administration.
So to depoliticize science, we begin with stem cells. Dr. George Daly, how depoliticized is it possible to be with stem cells, given that the bitter debate really is going to have repercussions even into the kinds of research that gets approved in the United States, assuming the federal government begins to fund it?
There's remarkably wide support in the American public for stem cell research. Everyone is affected, their loved ones or themselves, by disease. And stem cells represent a promising new opportunity to understand disease and treat disease. So I think that when people look through the political debate, what they see is an attempt to advance human health. And that's what the promise of stem cells offers.
This is Farai. Just, you know, one of the things that strikes me is someone I know actually recently was diagnosed with MS, and she's on, you know, one of these support boards, and they are, you know, by and large, the people on the support board, very thrilled by this change. What other kinds of diseases, I'm going to toss this to you, Dr. Daly, what kinds of diseases are really ones where people are watching this closely?
Well, the community of scientists and clinicians really believe that stem cells are a platform. They are a whole new way of approaching many, many diseases. You hear a tremendous amount about spinal cord injury, diabetes, Parkinson's, but even beyond those diseases, and there's much promise there, we're going to see the influence of stem cells across the board. It's just a major tool at our disposal, and we're going to see it having an impact in drug development, and we hope in the delivery of a new kind of medicine, that is cells as medicines.
What about anti-aging? I mean, there's so much focus on use of hormones as anti-aging and whether or not that works, whether what the dangers are. I'm curious if that factors into this at all.
It does. I mean, aging, we can approach as aging of us as organisms. But aging also occurs at the level of cells. And so stem cell research can indeed involve a study of aging and perhaps lead to drugs that can slow the ravages of aging at the single cell level.
Well, Dr. Daly and Cheryl, I hate to be a contrarian here, but as someone who's heard a lot of these claims about stem cell research for people with spinal cord injuries, and I am one, It seems that in some sense, the Michael J. Foxes with Parkinson's doing political commercials steps us away from the central reality, and that is most of the basic science on stem cells still remains to be done, that we're quite a ways removed from actual therapies with the possible exception of Parkinson's. But in general, it's basic science we're talking about here, not therapies that can come to market within the next 5 years.
You know, John, I think that's an interesting point in the public debate over this. You know, selling the notion of basic science doesn't really appeal to Americans. So when advocates talk about stem cell research, they like to talk about treatments and cures because that's something that ordinary people can get their mind around and can get behind. Wow, if we could cure Parkinson's disease or if we could cure diabetes, wouldn't this be great? Much harder to say we really want to do basic research into the understanding of these disorders. But in fact, you're right. That's what this this order that Mr. Obama is putting forth today will allow. And of course, you can't get to treatments and cures without doing the basic research. You have to put one foot in front of the other.
Dr. Daly, do you have a response on that, sort of the balancing line between basic research and calling for real hopeful therapies?
Yes. There is an enormous amount of basic research that needs to be done. But I want to point out that the first FDA-approved trial occurred just in the last few weeks for spinal cord injury. So indeed, there are going to be tests of embryonic stem cell-based medicines in patients with spinal cord injury. And I think that's just the first of many that you'll see. Yes, the focus now will be on basic research, and the time to get to patients will be long, and the real impact will be felt over many, many years. But we should get started now, and today is a very good day for that.
And the announcement from the Obama administration will be at 11:45 today. I'm presuming that might be one of the reasons why you're down in Washington, Dr. Daly. Is it important for the president to step away from the sort of more ideological debate on stem cells, or is it more important that the president, as commanding officer of science in America, step forward as an advocate? Which would you prefer, Dr. Daly?
Well, as a very, very thoughtful individual, I expect that he has looked at all sides of this issue and realizes that it does create challenges for some in our community. But I think he puts the emphasis on the need to advance human health, and in thinking about the many, many patients who are affected by these diseases, his announcement will indeed energize not only the scientific community, but all of those patients out there who are really looking for the hope for the future. I myself, I'm excited as a kid on Christmas morning. I woke up very early. I couldn't sleep. I think this is a great day for science and ultimately will be a great day for my patients.
And Cheryl, following up on this idea, you know, Dr. Daly saying it's a great day for science, is this going to produce a backlash? We have seen in, the past couple of years, debates over everything from evolution to stem cells. You know, this is political and religious territory as well as scientific territory. Do you anticipate a debate over the expansion of science in the Obama administration?
Well, you know, nothing happens in Washington without a fight, and no fight is as intense in Washington as anything that touches, even tangentially, on the abortion debate, and that's where this stem cell debate is. So as Dr. Daly was saying, it's a great day for science, I was thinking, yes, but it's a dark day for opponents of abortion, and they are already gearing up for a major fight over this. Not much they can do about it. President Obama has the power to do this by executive order.
Although, Cheryl, let me just add and just give me a couple of facts about this. It appears as though the big issue of actually experimenting on embryos has been punted into the Congress, right?
Well, that's exactly right. As I wrote in this morning's newspaper, I wouldn't say punted into the Congress. It is the purview of the Congress. The Congress imposes a ban on embryo experiments. It has every year since 1996. The president has no power to overturn that ban, and he's not going to take an issue on it.
And so that still remains up, and that will be subject to debate. We have to go. But for an excited doctor, George Daly, and for Cheryl Guest-Dolberg, a big story, a big headline on science today at the White House. Dr. George Daly is Associate Director of Stem Cell Programs at Children's Hospital in Boston, also at Harvard Medical School. Cheryl Guest-Dolberg is a reporter for The New York Times. Thanks to both of you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Farai Chidea, who's filling in for Adora Udoji. And we talked with Mike Gill at the top of the hour, who went from advertising executive to latte maker at Starbucks and loves his reinvention. Well, in a climate of more than a half million layoffs just last month, is it time to reinvent yourself? What do you think? What field have you never tried but always wanted to? Pottery? Opening your own coffee shop? Maybe something more recession-centric? Get into your greatest fear. If there is a layoff in your future, how would you reinvent yourself? Choose a new career at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right?
And unemployment hit a 25-year high on Friday. Ouch! Americans are struggling. We want to focus on ways to survive. As the rate goes up, the joblessness rate, it's becoming almost commonplace for American workers to consider a plan of action in case they get laid off. I was actually traveling this weekend and met a woman in the airport who basically just started talking to me. And she was like, yeah, I'm reporting back to HQ because I'm going to be laid off. They haven't told me yet, but I know it's going to happen. It's that kind of feeling that people have, and they're usually right. So,
That's spooky.
It is. She just needed someone to talk to. And so we have with us now Callie Yost, who blogs for Fast Company magazine on the subject of work and life. She's got some vision for us. And, you know, one of the things that's really fascinating is a lot of folks assume that laying people off is cost effective. There's now some questioning of whether or not that's the only option. And tell us, you know, about those questions, and then we'll get to the specifics of, you know, how much the cost benefit analysis is.
Well, first, I think it's important to say that in some instances, layoffs really are going to be inevitable if it's an industry that's restructuring. But managers think that if they lay someone off who makes $50,000, they're going to save $50,000. And actually, that's not true. It's going to cost them more than that $50,000 to let someone go. And that's why the research shows that layoffs tend to be a short-term fix without a lot of long-term profit benefits. So,
well, how does that work mathematically? I mean, the person isn't coming in and they aren't getting paid. So what are the costs?
Well, the estimate is anywhere between the cost of a layoff is anywhere between 150% to 250% of a person's salary.
For that year?
Well, no, going forward.
Going forward,
because
right.
What happens is there are a lot of associated costs with a layoff that we don't take into consideration. So, for example, there's severance, there's the payout of vacation, there's outplacement services, there's benefits continuation, unemployment insurance premiums, the cost of having it goes on and on and on. So you really don't get that immediate savings. And the question then becomes, okay, so what does a manager do that faces the very real need to manage their labor costs in this recession? And the fact is there are flexible alternatives to layoffs that allow you to get the benefit of labor cost savings without all of these associated expenses related to layoffs. And that includes reducing schedules and salaries. It includes job sharing. It includes furloughs. It includes adding unpaid vacation days to the year. And it allows not only the manager to save the cost, but people to keep jobs in a time when it's a little tough to get one.
Are people willing to really take the cut? Because, you know, we've talked about this. If you're in an office of, you know, or a division of five people and one could be cut or you could each work 4 days, that's a significant nut out of your salary. Are people in general willing to take that kind of a cut versus seeing someone go?
You know, I'm finding they are.
Really?
So you're
negotiating as groups?
Yep.
Really?
Yeah, because, well, here's the first thing. Number one, it is not on the manager's radar screen to offer these flexible options. They really do go right to cuts, unfortunately, because we've lost track of a historical precedent of doing this. Back in the 80s, we did take a more flexible approach to labor cost savings. We lost it the last 20 or so years, and now it's not on their radar screen. So people go in and say, look, if you're thinking of laying me off, why don't we just all take a 10% cut in pay? Why don't we add six unpaid vacation days? We'll take a 2-week furlough. And you get pretty far into your cost savings by doing that.
Now, that sounds more likely than what occurred to me when you were talking before, is you can't lay me off. It'll bring down the company, man. That probably isn't going to be as persuasive as coming with all the workers and having a variety of flexible things to do.
Exactly.
Well, one of the things you talk about whole movement talks about is the administrative cost of processing the layoff. But there's also the question of team building.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that when you have people who start disappearing, that it drives down morale. Does it drive down productivity?
It across the board,
right.
Morale, productivity, the willingness to stay at the company when things turn around. Really, these are the costs that don't get factored in when managers think about downsizing. And they really, it's a direct bottom line hit when these things.
And is this in every sector? Are we talking just about sort of the office kind of scene where you're talking about white collar workers? Or is this also true in the manufacturing line? Is it true in service industries as well?
Well, that 150% number is really very conservative. That is a very much on sort of the not knowledge worker. That's when you get into the 250%. And I know you see your face, you're surprised. Yes, because if you think about it, a knowledge worker, let's say, they're walking out the door with years and years of contacts, of knowing how to get the job done. And you know what? That is never coming back, because the next person who comes to fill that job, which is actually what happens also in layoffs, is they're hiring at the same time. Studies have shown that very rarely do you have a layoff and then there isn't rehiring. So you're not going to hire in, though, those contacts and that knowledge of how to get the job done.
So if you're a high seniority, relatively high salary employee, your best bet to prevent a layoff is what?
To go in and say, look, here's the story. I'll take a 20% cut in pay and let me work with you to try to get this business to recover. Here's how we can work together. And then when it recovers, I'm here to hit the ground running.
Well, this is fascinating stuff. Callie, thanks.
Thank you very much.
That's Callie Yost, work and life blogger for Fast Company. And now we have Femi Okeh with more news.
Good morning, Farai. Good morning, all. 28 minutes past the hour is the time. The Obama White House is set to end a Bush administration limits on funding on embryonic stem cell research. The reversal is one of President Obama's campaign promises. The president intends to make the change via executive order. This means that scientists will be able to apply for federal funding to work on newer stem cell lines. The Bush administration had limited publicly funded research to a tiny group of lines created before 2001. Vice President Joe Biden heads to Brussels today. He will talk about Afghanistan and Pakistan with NATO allies. President Obama ordered a review of policy there, and this is part of a shift in the U.S. military focus away from Iraq. And the president recently sent 17,000 more troops to Afghanistan to combat increasing violence. A wide-ranging study on American religious life finds a decline in the percentage of Christians, though it's still the dominant faith by far in the country. About 3/4 of Americans call themselves Christians, and the survey also shows more Americans choosing no religion, and that number is now at 15%.
So the growth is no religion and Muslims, maybe?
Well, the growth is no religion. There's a bigger percentage of people saying, I'm not affiliated
to
any
faith. Interesting.
Well, you know, President Obama also took the time to mention
atheists.
No
right.
religion.
That's right, no religion. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
At first you don't succeed. dust yourself off and try again.
A lot of folks are trying again, trying to find a new career. I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora Udoji on maternity leave. Now, if you are someone who has lost your job or think that you are going to lose your job, are you doing a complete redirection of your career? Maybe you're that physician's aide who always wanted to be a pastry chef. Are you going to stay in the same career? Tell us your new chosen...
That is the same career, actually. Physician's assistant and pastry chef. That's
oh, yeah.
Not a change.
Yeah,
they're basically the same.
Oh, yeah, right. I think one's a little sweeter than the other.
Ooh, nice.
877-8-MY-TAKE is the phone number, or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Tell us your what you wanted to try, but might now.
Disturbing story out of Northern Ireland over the weekend. Dissident nationalists shot dead two soldiers in a British Army barracks on Saturday night. And all of a sudden, the so-called troubles between Northern Ireland and Britain and Ireland are all back in the news. Here's Prime Minister Gordon Brown of the UK.
No murderer will be able to derail a peace process that has the support of the vast majority of the people of Northern Ireland. And we will step up our efforts to make the peace process one that lasts and endures.
Can this latest incident provide enough repercussions and ripples to derail the peace process or at least set it back? Joining us now is Colette Hume, who's BBC correspondent in Northern Ireland. She joins us from County Antrim. Colette, first of all, what are the latest details on what we know about the incident that took place Saturday night?
Well, let me first of all tell you that just as I'm standing here outside the barracks, people are laying floral tributes. And all through this morning here, people have been laying flowers and wreaths for the two young men who have died in this attack. Now, earlier this morning, we heard from the commanding officer here who said that what had happened was this, that on Saturday evening at around 9:20 GMT, the local pizza place took a call from soldiers based here at the barracks. They were just hours away from going to deploy to Afghanistan, to Helmand province, and they wanted to have one last pizza with their friends before they left the barracks to catch a flight over to Afghanistan. That pizza, in fact, two pizzas, were separately delivered by guys from Domino's Pizzas at just before 10 o'clock. As they pulled up to the barracks where I'm standing talking to you now, a car which was following them came to a halt, and at least two gunmen got out. And they basically used an automatic weapon to shoot repeatedly at a group of four soldiers. And indeed, they also attacked the two pizza delivery men. Now, as we now know, two of those soldiers were killed in the attack. Two others were very, very badly injured. And just to give you an idea of the ferocity of that attack, it is now Monday morning here in Northern Ireland, and there is still a pool of blood just outside the barracks, and there are bullet holes in the walls of the sentry post. More than 40 shots were fired in total.
Oh, that's a remarkably vivid and brutal scene. A group calling itself the Real IRA claimed responsibility. Where might they have come from, and what do they represent?
Okay, well, they are a dissident group of Republicans who split from the IRA that many people will know about from their campaign of violence and terror right through the 70s to the 90s. Now, this splinter group did not want to get involved in the peace process. They didn't want to take part in the democratic process, and they split off. They're a very disorganized gang of people, but they are showing increasingly that they are able to deploy and able to carry out attacks with deadly accuracy. I think probably the attack that that many people in the U.S. will perhaps remember is the Omar bombing back in 1998, when 29 people in a market town in Northern Ireland were killed, including a woman who was pregnant with twins. That was a bomb attack carried out by the Real IRA. Now, they have been known more for targeting business premises and shops and industry in the recent past, but they are changing tack. Just a few weeks ago, when I was here in Northern Ireland, the police and the security services defused a 300-pound car bomb in a place called Caffawellan, which is about 35, 40 kilometres from Belfast. And, of course, now the Real IRA, this small dissident group, have claimed responsibility for this attack, and they say they were simply attacking soldiers who, as far as they are concerned, are occupying the north of Ireland.
And Colette, when you think about the fact that the Prime Minister, the UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown, came to Northern Ireland to try to address this, does the UK, does Britain specifically have having a lot of leverage in this situation, or not so much?
Has a great deal of leverage. I think there are a couple of important points to make about the fact that the Prime Minister comes here, is that he is sending out a very clear signal, first of all, that the London government is totally united with the government here in Northern Ireland in condemning these attacks. It's a show of support. And also on a very personal and intimate level, Gordon Brown here this morning met many members of staff here at the barracks, and indeed some of the soldiers who were involved in what happened late on Saturday night. Now, Gordon Brown will also be having a series of meetings today with the First Minister of Northern Ireland, the Democratic Unionist Party President Peter Robinson. He'll also be meeting the former IRA member Martin McGuinness, who is the Deputy First Minister here in Northern Ireland, and there'll be a series of talks about what's happened. Now, certainly some people here in the north of Ireland have said, oh, this is going to derail the peace process. How can we possibly have a situation where decommissioning has happened, where the main terrorist groups don't have guns, when all this is...
That was Colette Hume, BBC correspondent in Northern Ireland, reporting there quite vividly from the Massareen Barracks in County Antrim in Northern Ireland, which was the scene of a brutal shooting on Saturday night, where two soldiers were gunned down by members of the Real IRA, a group that is focusing on military targets. To what end? Concessions from Britain or destabilization of Northern Ireland? We do not know. Thank you very much, Colette Hume of the BBC. And now Femi Okay with headlines.
Thank you, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Asian markets fell today amid some gloomy economic news. Japan's Nikkei fell to its lowest rate in 26 years. Now, all this is happening while oil and gas prices are up just a little bit. Oil prices rose above $46 a barrel today, pumped up by the expectation of an OPEC production cut. Staying in Asia, routine military drills between South Korea and the US are especially tense today. North Korea calls the exercises preparation for an invasion. This is just the latest in a series of provocative moves by Pyongyang. Recently, the North warned it couldn't guarantee the safety of civilian aircraft in its area, forcing airlines to reroute flights. And it's reportedly close to testing a long-range missile, although North Korea says that they will be testing a satellite. We have news this morning of another mega merger in the drug industry. Merck will buy rival Schering Plough for $41 billion. Both companies are based in New Jersey. And this just after Pfizer's $68 billion purchase of Wyeth. And President Obama was among the well-wishers on hand for Senator Ted Kennedy's 77th birthday party yesterday. It happened at the Kennedy Center in D.C. The senator stood and gave a thumbs up from his balcony.
And he got the award named after his brother.
I know.
You know, that's a
keep
closing
it in the family.
Of the circle. Yes, indeed. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora Udoji. Tens of thousands of American and South Korean forces have begun their annual joint military exercises in South Korea, and the North Korean authorities are making their feelings clear. They say it's a dangerous provocation. The tension between Seoul and Pyongyang that's been building since North Korea started preparing to launch a satellite is rising. Some countries say they're concerned the launch will be a long-range missile test. We've got John Sudworth, BBC correspondent in South Korea. Why are tensions so high over something that on the surface doesn't seem to be that serious?
Well, that's a very good question. These military exercises, a joint exercise between United States and South Korean troops, take place every year. They are large in scale. North Korea always complains about them, always complains that they are, in its view, a rehearsal for invasion. But the interesting question is why its complaints appear to be more serious in nature this time round. And I think we have to look to that planned satellite launch, as North Korea calls it, something that the United States and Japan and other regional governments here, though, believe will in fact be simply a cover for a long-range missile test. The governments here have been united in condemning North Korea for that. And in fact, the US and Japan have even hinted that they may shoot down that rocket launch if they believe it's necessary to do so, something that has infuriated North Korea. And I think that's why we're seeing this rise in tension now.
Well, let's go to a little bit of William Wheaton, a U.S. military commander, where the maneuvers are taking place. And he says North Korea's fears are unjustified.
I can say that I honestly believe that the exercise is not designed to prepare for an attack on North Korea, but to defend the Republic of Korea from North Korean aggression.
John, do we know what, you know, when you say military exercises, what literally are we talking about?
Well, they are large in scale. They involve the air forces, the navies, as well as a large number of ground troops from both of the allies. They involve, essentially, according to the allies, a wargaming scenario for the defense of South Korea, if that was ever necessary. I've covered these exercises before. Occasionally, the United States will bring in a large aircraft carrier, for example, and they invite the press, local journalists, as well as international journalists, to see a lot of what they're doing. And they're always very keen to stress that these exercises are defensive in nature. And they also point out, of course, that North Korea will hold its own military exercises. All armies, of course, have to practice what they do. So I think the view here in the South is that North Korea, if you like, is using this exercise as a pretext to raise tension, and partly, as I said earlier, because of its sensitivity over this planned rocket launch that it says will be a satellite, others fear otherwise.
So, John, I guess the question really is, will these exercises end with some fundamental change in the North Korean story, or is it just an escalation of tensions and we'll see where it goes?
It seems at the moment it's very unlikely that North Korea appears willing to compromise. Of course, the international community will be doing all it can to convince it not to launch that rocket, mm-hmm. and trying as many ways as possible to keep pressure on North Korea to make sure it doesn't happen.
All right, John. Thanks so much. John Sudworth, BBC correspondent in South Korea.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Getting fired from corporate America, best thing that ever happened? Our next guest will tell us why reinvention is actually a great reality in this economic downturn. But first, Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The Obama White House is set to end Bush administration limits on funding on embryonic stem cell research. The reversal is one of President Obama's campaign promises. The president intends to make the changes via executive order today, and this means that scientists will be able to apply for federal funding to work on newer stem cell lines. Members of the Obama Administration Auto Task Force will meet with senior GM and Chrysler executives in Detroit. They also will talk to some top union leaders. The automakers want tens of billions in government loans. Circuit City, the second largest electronics store in the country, closed down yesterday. The company has been selling off its $1.7 billion inventory since November and cleared its shelves quicker than expected. Last-minute bargain shoppers at Circuit City, New York, shopped one last time yesterday.
This is killing me. This is my Christmas shopping is all done right here. I live in Stuyvesant Town, so I don't have a far walk. In a building this big, I'm afraid, I bet it's going to be condos, and I hope it's not condos.
Well, there are 567 Circuit City stores now vacant, and more than 34,000 employees have been laid off.
Parking garages for unsold cars, I'd say.
A lot of space available right now. One more international story, John, before I go. In Africa, Zimbabwe's Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai is back home after a car crash that injured him and killed his wife. The truck driver involved is in court today. His lawyer says that he will plead not guilty to culpable homicide. And Tsvangirai has tangled with his longtime Zimbabwe president, Robert Mugabe, for years. Now, some have raised the possibility of foul play when the story originally broke on Friday. But the Prime Minister, Tsvangirai, says today that there was no foul play in the crash that killed his wife.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Starting today, we must pick ourselves up.
Pick myself up.
Dust ourselves off.
Dust myself off.
And begin again the work of remaking America.
Start all over again.
You don't succeed. Yeah. Dust yourself off and try again.
Reinvention. It's not just for people with parachutes anymore. Barack Obama talked about reinvention and remaking ourselves in America as the economic recession and downturn takes hold. Well, he reinvented himself. He was once a senator. Now he's the president. Well, following in the Obama footsteps, there are millions of Americans who have lost their jobs or who anticipate losing their jobs, who have to get from there to here, from what I once was to what I can and will be. It's a trajectory that follows unemployment that doesn't necessarily mean you have to be laid off to think about reinventing yourself. Joining us now are Gail Ambrosius, who's a chocolatier in Madison, Wisconsin. Gail, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
And in the studio, you heard his voice at the top of the hour, Mike Gill, who is an author and Starbucks employee. You used to be a creative director at an ad firm.
That's right.
You were in corporate America.
I was very much in the heart of the beast.
And in the best thing that ever happened to you, you told me at the top of the hour, was
getting fired.
Getting fired. All right. So you got to think in this way to be able to reinvent yourself. Gail, what was the best thing that ever happened to you in your career?
Getting my pink slip.
And when
I was laid off
about
5 years ago. About 5 years ago from the state of Wisconsin. I was an employee at the Department of Natural Resources, and I was a cartographer.
A map maker, right?
That's right. Right. That's right.
Now, how do you go from cartographer to chocolatier? And what were the moments when you thought to yourself, my gosh, what's an unemployed map maker going to do in Wisconsin?
Well, I kind of fell in love with the idea of making chocolate way back when I was 17. But, you know, I kind of let go of that idea because people thought, well, that's not a really good job, or you've got to get something very stable and secure like a state government job. So I went to school and I got the job, but I never let go of that idea. And when I got my pink slip, I thought, yay, here's my chance. Now I can be the chocolatier I've always wanted to be.
Now, of course, that was 5 years ago. For you, Mike, it was 10 years ago, right?
Yes.
Very different economy now.
Yes.
Do you have any words for people who are laid off and getting pink slips and maybe not jumping for joy in this economic environment?
Well, I think it is a terrible shock to be fired, especially like myself. I defined myself through my job, and I burst into tears literally the day I got fired. But I think my advice would be to let that go, because it was only when I gave up my feeling of my previous self as this top advertising guy that I was able to move on in my life. And I think the key thing is to just say, okay, I'm fired, have a big cry, shake your fist at the universe, and then get on with your life, because forward motion, it works. At least for me, I found this job where I'm so much happier today than I ever was in the corporate world.
You know, Mike, this is Farai. Yeah. I've been sitting in for Adora Udoji, who's on maternity leave. Anyway, one thing that strikes me about what you just said is that it sounds awfully like some of the Buddhist teachings, that you can become overly defined with, you know, with any number of worldly things. It sounds as if you're someone who's willing to shed your skin in order to move on. But a lot of people cling to these identities that we've built up over years of work.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very you make a very wise, I think, and profound point. By the way, it took me years to get there, because you know, but I think that that's the key, which is you have to shed all those feelings of defining yourself by, you know, I was still dressing up in Brooks Brothers suits long after I was ever going to get back into that executive suite. And so it's only when I gave it up and said, okay, I'll wear a green apron and serve coffee to others and serve others, because I think what we forget in life is that we aren't our jobs. We are people who have a life. You know, in America, we always say, what do you do to people? But it's actually who you are. So look inside your own heart. That's one of my, in my book, I say one of the key things is to follow your own heart. Touch your heart and say, what do you love to do? And in my case, I love serving others and making them happy through just the simple things in life, even cleaning a toilet rather than trying to sit in these crazy meetings I used to do.
All right, Mike, can I call you Yoda? Let's do some of the numbers here. Gail, you went from a salary of what to what you're making now, and how did you deal with that with your other responsibilities?
Oh, boy. Well, I was a single mom at the time. My son was in high school, and I've now got him into college, and I've paid for 2 years of college so far.
Whoa.
So I'm pretty proud of myself.
Not bad. For you, Mike, yeah. What do you do for people who get fired who have kids and they've got tuitions to pay?
No, it's a huge sort of traumatic shock.
I mean, you took an 80% pay cut,
yes,
right, at
least. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I had to do was to lower my overhead just in a very simple, mundane way. You know, I used to buy these $3,000 suits. In the last 5 years, I bought one pair of khaki pants and two black shirts. And that's my overhead. The other thing is, the big surprise, John, was that by lowering my overhead, getting rid of all that stuff, I thought a big house was essential and a big lifestyle and all that stuff. I'm so much happier now. I have my dining room table is like a picnic, white plastic picnic table, $53. In other words, you adapt, and guess what? The good news is we don't maybe need all that fancy stuff.
Well, the economy needs the economic activity, that's for sure, if you were going to believe the Treasury Secretary. Gail, is downsizing a joyful endeavor?
It's kind of scary at first, but I think you, like he said, you have to really look at what's important to you and, you know, really prioritize your life. I realized, you know, my son was my priority and he was my motivation for succeeding in my business. And it is. It's all about reinventing yourself. You know, nothing stands still. We're in a dynamic world. You have to adapt.
And your book, Mike, I should mention, is How Starbucks Saved My Life, A Son of Privilege Learns to Live Like Everyone Else. Is it true that you feel more bonded to everyone else by doing the job that you're doing at Starbucks?
That's, John, that's another big gift to me, because if I just continued in my corporate life and ended up dying, say, in that, I would have believed that, you know, I deserved all that stuff because I was so smart. And when I got in Starbucks, you know, I realized, boy, you know, I wasn't overqualified. I was almost underqualified because I met people from way different kinds of backgrounds, much, you know, who didn't have all the advantages I had with my Yale education and everything, who were way outperforming me.
Well, I hear the excitement. I totally hear the excitement in your voice. Gail, what's the best thing about your chocolate?
Well, I think it's similar. It's connecting with people. You know, I'm making this product that puts smiles on faces. You know, people buy it to celebrate joyous occasions, just to make themselves feel good. I think, you know, we all could use a little more happiness, and it's just really a pleasure to be able to deliver that.
Well, from map maker to chocolatier, Gail Ambrosius from Madison, Wisconsin, thanks so much for that journey.
You're welcome.
And Mike Gill, author and Starbucks employee in our studio, from ad exec to a Starbucks employee, from a latte server.
Right.
Mike, thanks so much for being with us. So if you lost your job, how are you going to proceed? Will you stay in the same career path? It's time to reinvent yourself. What field have you never tried but always wanted to? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Can you beat the excitement in Gail and Mike's voices? If you missed anything, of course, you want our podcast to go. You can get it at thetakeaway.org. And maybe you can convince your boss to stay. One of our podcast segments is with the Callie Yost, and you should find out her advice for people trying to prevent layoffs.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Huckaberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.